Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with the executive editor of Newsbusters, your host, Tim Graham.
Hello and welcome to the last Newsbusters podcast of this difficult year of 2020. Here on a lonely day in the office with my son and producer, Benjamin Superman, I could really use the mental refreshment of a new calendar year. Although the virus is still wreaking serious havoc right now, but with my personality, I just keep laser focused on the vaccines. Let's get the good news spreading so we can end all the bad news. It would be nice to have a different topic. It would be nice to not have a daily death toll on screen for 12 hours. On Sunday, CNN's reliable sources spent an hour reanalyzing, kind of like a rerun, the trauma of the Trump presidency and how journalists, and especially CNN, bravely resisted this menace. Well, the big headline of this show was CNN host Jake Tapper proclaiming he just won't lower himself to interviewing horrible liars like Kayleigh McEnany, who he said lies the way that most people breathe. Look, this right now at this stage where the Trump campaign and the White House are proclaiming that somehow they won in a landslide, if everybody could just understand, after all of these court defeats, you could certainly see that the press secretary is saying exactly what the president wants her to say. On the other hand, you would say the same for, say, Mike McCurry in the Clinton years. Mike McCurry in the Clinton years during the year of Lewinsky would pretend that he didn't know what was going on. His actual professional position was calculated ignorance. And then Tapper claimed in this segment with Brian Stelter, despite all the CNN theatrics, always wailing against Trump, who's always destroying democracy, Tapper says, we're not wired as human beings for conflict. We're actually wired against it. You know, that's why people get away with lying on so many interview shows, just because it's difficult to confront somebody. Why is he trying this line? CNN's never found it difficult to confront a Republican. Where would Tapper get the idea that cable news is not wired for conflict? That cable news is somehow based on the idea of an audience out there that's not wired for conflict? Was he clinging to this old Jon Stewart trope from 2004 that debate shows like Crossfire were bad for the country? I mean, you remember that. That's when Tucker Carlson was the conservative half on CNN. I think it was Tucker Carlson and Bill Press. And they took Jon Stewart so seriously, they basically canceled Crossfire. Tapper continued, I think one of the things about the Trump era was you kind of had to steel yourself for interviews with people that might misrepresent the facts and might at a certain point prove themselves to be a liar. I had to stop booking them. Sometimes you had to steel yourself for an interview because you just didn't know how off the rails it might go. Well, look, we understand the way that CNN did this. They would have these elongated, like 25-minute interviews where they were constantly interrupting the subject of the interview, let's say Kellyanne Conway. And we know from the New York Times reporting that Jeff Zucker, the boss, was yelling in Tapper's ear and probably other anchors' ears, telling them what to say. They were wired for conflict. There was no doubt about it. You know, I think the thing that bothers me sometimes is that CNN pretends, we were special. We did this special for the Trump years. We were usually much more normal. I mean, does Jake Tapper remember the CNN of 1998? Because a lot of us do. This was the network that let the Clintons misrepresent the facts for months on end. They tried to suggest Monica Lewinsky was wrong. She was delusional. She was making stuff up that Bill Clinton gave her a book of poetry because he's just a nice guy. CNN began the whole Lewinsky scandal by abjectly apologizing that we were all suffering from quote-unquote media madness. This was the CNN that within a couple of weeks was hating the special prosecutor. They hated Ken Starr just as much as they adored Robert Mueller. Within weeks, they'd aired a special titled Investigating the Investigator, and they were highlighting liberal Democrats saying Starr should be removed from office. Anyone who wanted Mueller removed was killing democracy. But you can look at our archives and see CNN hosts comparing Ken Starr to wife-murdering O.J. Simpson, comparing Bill Clinton to unjustly accused security guard Richard Jewell. By October, when it became quite obvious Clinton was guilty of this sexual harassment of a lowly intern, the DNA tests were in. And Bruce Morton was just tapping on the media line that Ken Starr had violated all norms of privacy of the poor intern exploiting president. Morton turned to literature. If this reminds you of George Orwell's novel 1984, it should. The government in that book poked and pried everywhere. Its slogan was, "Big Brother is watching you." And with the aid of the thought police, he was. Welcome to Orwell's world. I think if we had a part of the government that was poking and prying everywhere, it was Bill Clinton. But these are the double standards of CNN. This is the partisanship of CNN. You know, most politically involved people are tempted to apply double standards. We all have this idea of whose ox is gored, whose interest is helped or harmed. But the media love to pretend they're above such a thing, that they are somehow the objective or disinterested people. That's where we have always come in. At least Tapper was admitting what Brian Stelter often denies, that CNN lives to dish out opinionated monologues. The way Tapper said it was, "We felt in many ways the need to do more aggressive fact-checking." The monologues, whatever you call them, on Sunday we call them homilies. During the week we call them murrows. That's the nickname for what we call them, but it's basically a time to just turn to the camera and just present some facts in a way that might clear up where there is obfuscation about matters of decency or matters of fact. This is the way CNN poses itself. They are the guardians of fact. They are the guardians of decency. I like how Steve Krakauer, in his Fourth Watch newsletter, quickly raised Keith Olbermann here when they're discussing the Murrows. Olbermann loved to imagine himself as a modern Edward R. Murrow. Just like Murrow, Tapper and Olbermann want to make a pompous statement, like everyone should pause and absorb the worldly wisdom of journalists. And of course, this is going to change. Inaugurate Biden, and suddenly the whole CNN pattern goes back to the Clinton pattern. Tapper admitted he's not sure if we're going to have the need to continue to do those Murrows quite the same way in a Biden administration. I kind of suspect news media coverage will change as a quote-unquote more normal president takes office. I mean, I think we could admit Trump was not the normal. Trump was the opposite of normal. The problem with this whole analogy is George W. Bush was a normal president. Reagan was a normal president. George H.W. Bush was a normal president. And CNN ripped them. More so as time went on. CNN, when I got here in 89, was fairly sober. But what happened was the network veterans, once CNN got established, started coming over to CNN. So you got somebody like pompous Bruce Morton showing up on CNN, and then soon CNN was just like CBS. CNN was just like ABC and NBC. So there's a new article in The Atlantic. I did the column on this. McKay Coppins noted the end of an era, you know, when journalists were toasted as the resistance to Trump. It became a lucrative enterprise where they all could have best-selling books, and they were all being toasted in late-night shows by Seth Meyers or Trevor Noah or Jimmy Kimmel. Coppins turned to Jim Acosta, Mr. Screamer, and Acosta admitted he didn't expect to bring the same what he calls crusading style to the Democrats. He said, "I don't think the press should be trying to whip up the Biden presidency and turn it into must-see TV in a contrived way." A contrived way, which basically describes everything that Acosta's been doing with Trump. But, of course, Acosta claimed this double standard isn't partisan. It's a matter of professional solidarity. He claims Trump's incessant press criticism was somehow a nonstop national emergency that required poor Jim to throw lectures instead of questions. He said, "If being at the White House is not an experience that might merit hazard pay, then perhaps it's going to be approached differently." Coppins also went to another CNN activist, the so-called fact-checker, Daniel Dale, hired from the Toronto Star after a lot of hot anti-Trump tweets. Naturally, Dale told Coppins, fact-checking the president won't be a 24/7 job anymore. Oh, he'll apply the same quote-unquote intensity and rigor. But Biden doesn't lie like Trump does. So Dale says he'll spend more time debunking online misinformation and digging into claims made by congressional leaders. Yeah, we know what that means. In other words, you expect the fact-checkers to keep checking the Republicans and the conservatives as the most energetic fact-manglers in America. Never believe a liberal journalist when they say they're going to bring the same intensity to the Biden administration that they brought to Trump, just because their intensity during Trump was at an 11. They turn it to 11 or 12. They're about to turn it down to 4. Some people may try at least to remain somewhat skeptical in tone. We'll say, let's pick out John Carl for an example. John Carl would ask decently tough questions in the Obama years. They didn't make television. John Carl may still ask somewhat aggressive questions in the briefing, and nobody will really notice. I mean, we would certainly notice because the pattern and practice of Biden the candidate is he gets a lot of cotton candy questions from his press corps. So, we'll certainly notice if they give us any sign of actually asking a question Biden doesn't like. Pretty much now we just have Peter Doocy of Fox and to some extent Mr. Erickson at CBS. I mean, you know that when Biden gets snippy that they've asked a question he didn't like. But, when it comes to fact-checking, this has always been a very partisan enterprise with the liberals. And this is our work here at Newsbusters, to chronicle the rhetorical opportunism of the liberal media. Facts matter. Facts are important. But a lot of what they call the news is spin. Spin is king. Now, allow me to spend a little time analyzing the recent publicity tour of one Matthew Sheffield. He likes to proclaim himself as the founder of Newsbusters. Well, look, I remember getting the first call from Matt, who suggested the MRC should start a blog back in 2005. I had been writing blogs for National Review Online, first at The Corner, and then on their media blog, and blogging was fun. I wasn't sure Brent Bozell would go for this idea, or at least the way that Matt was describing it. Web blogs were still a bit on the new side. We haven't always been on the cutting edge, although we've been there on the internet. But we were certainly qualified to do it. We were qualified to sort of take our old-fashioned monthly newsletter approach that had gotten old. We had moved to a cyber alert daily mode with Newsbusters. We were going to go to an a minute-by-minute mode. When I started, it was sort of like working in a library. It was calm. You were on a monthly cycle. You know, these days we're on an hourly or minute-by-minute cycle here. Anyway, this, Matt would come and he makes it sound like, you know, he was the intellectual architect of the whole thing. And he had grand opinions on the media. But for us, you know, what did he bring to us? Well, his contribution was primarily as an IT professional. He knew how to set up the infrastructure for a blog on Drupal. But when you listen to his recent comments, he suggests he was not just the Newsbusters founder, he was the savior, since apparently he had so much to teach us. The Sheffield Shamble began on November 6th with a Twitter thread that was celebrated by the left. And here's where in this thread that we came in, Matt tweeted, "As the co-creator of Newsbusters, the most prominent anti-media website, I was part of a decades-long tradition of complaining about media elites being, quote-unquote, unfair to conservative views. There is still much to that argument, but eventually I saw that I was missing context. What I did not realize until I began expanding my work into creating actual media and reporting institutions such as the Washington Examiner," and he has to throw in, "I was the founding online editor at the Examiner, was that U.S. conservatives do not understand the purpose of journalism." Then he added, "I also discovered as I rose through the right-wing media ranks that most conservative media figures have no journalism training or desire to fact-check their own side." This is where Matt's working assumption that almost everyone is dumber than he is just comes crashing through. When he came to us with this blog proposal in 2005, Brent Baker and Rich Noyce had been doing media analysis since their college days at George Washington University in the mid-1980s, working with professors like Dr. Robert Lichter. 20 years of experience. By 2005, Jeff Dickens had been here 10 years. He had journalism training at the University of Indiana. Mr. Baker worked for the alternative college newspaper at GW. I also ran an alternative college newspaper at Bemidji State. I minored in mass communications there, but all my friends and most of my time was spent in the mass comm hangouts, the radio and TV stations. I came to D.C., and in 1987, I interned with the National Journalism Center and with the columnists Evans and Novak. I worked most of 1988 as a deputy press secretary for a Republican congressman. I spent 2001 and 2002 as a White House correspondent. So the idea that Matt Sheffield has here, that we had no journalism training, is just simply false. It's preposterous. But here's how Matt doubled down on this then with an interview he gave to the New York Times about this Twitter thread. He said, "I basically built the infrastructure for a lot of conservative online people and personally taught a lot of them what they know." What an arrogant bucket of lies. We knew when he was here, he was impressed with himself, but this really takes the cake. So Matt came in with his brother Greg, who was not someone you would read his articles and assume that he had any journalism training. And, you know, I used to joke around the office that these two brothers reminded me of the cartoon Pinky and the Brain. Matt always seemed to want to take over the world. Look, you don't need journalism training. You don't need a bachelor's degree in journalism to be a media critic. You know, as Brent Baker has pointed out many times, reporters typically present themselves as experts in all kinds of fields where they have no degrees. In 2020, they've all presented themselves as infectious disease experts. Some days they're all climatologists. Some days they're all military or intelligence experts. They're always posing as all-knowing people. Speaking of all-knowing, Sheffield's thread was celebrated by some of the most infamous propagandists on the left. Keith Olbermann, in between his videos about sending Trump to prison, wrote, "This is an important thread that confirms what a lot of us who have been attacked by newsbusters and other conservative watchdogs have asserted for 25 years. We had violated not their standards of truth, but their standards of dogma. I applaud Mr. Sheffield's epiphany." Yeah, Matt fancies himself as a grand theorist of politics, but his current view of conservatism is very insulting. The New York Times asked him to explain the most important things about right-wing media that people, liberals, don't understand. And so Matt proclaimed, "Almost all right-wing support in the United States comes from a view that Christians are under attack by secular liberals. This point is so important and so little understood. Logic doesn't matter. Fact-checking doesn't matter. What matters is if I can use this information to show that liberals are evil. Many of them are not interested in reporting the world as it is, but rather to shape the world like they want it to be." Now, this to me seems like a bit of projection. This seems to me like a bit of a mirror image. And that certainly would be our critique of the liberal media. They don't want to report the world as it is. They want to report the world as how the right side of history is going to end up. But I mean, to me, the insult in this is the idea, logic doesn't matter. Fact-checking doesn't matter. Only victory for the right-wingers matters, you know. Of course, anybody who wants to be persuasive in politics wants to show logic. They want to look factual. Facts matter. But in political disputes, people can be very choosy about which facts matter. And you don't have to argue that liberals are evil to argue that their policies are wrong-headed. We can certainly state that Christians are under attack from secular liberals. That is not some sort of fiction. The so-called culture wars are real, and both sides are fighting it. On abortion, on LGBTQ demands, on the right to worship in churches right now. This brings us to Matt's grand claim that he was disenchanted with conservatives because they failed to understand his expansive views on religion. On November 13, a week after the original Twitter thread, Sheffield was interviewed on the NPR syndicated show On the Media, produced by WNYC in New York. On public radio stations across the country, here was more besmirching of those of us who somehow didn't know what journalism was and didn't care about the facts at all. The interviewer here was Brooke Gladstone.
His Twitter ID reads, "I built conservative media and am now working to help free people from it."
I could go on and give you particular instances where I saw people playing fast and loose with the truth. But honestly, I don't think we have time for that. The overall thing that I noticed was that the people that I was working with, that I was reading, a lot of them, or even most of them, they didn't have an understanding of journalism. Their job was to attack the left. That's all it was. And so they didn't care if they said something that was untrue, they would just erase it.
Of course, they had much the same to say about what they considered mainstream media or lefty media or lamestream media or whatever they wanted to call it, that their concerns were only to advance political positions too.
Yes, but the people who I knew who were in the mainstream press, they were just trying to report what they found, and that was it. They may have brought their personal biases to it, but they weren't trying to propagandize the public the way that a lot of my colleagues were. Essentially, conservatives believe that everything is relative, that facts are relative, that everything is an opinion.
There he goes again, asserting that conservatives don't believe in objective facts, and we believe everything is merely an opinion. But he had a new argument on this show, that he had written most of a book and had been rejected by his so-called friends. He claimed, "I could have written the best prose in human history and the most persuasive data, and it wouldn't matter. I realized then that that I couldn't publish this book because I didn't want to be part of a movement that was intolerant of secular people or Muslims or LGBT people. I couldn't do that. What? Because the conservatives were intolerant, he couldn't publish this book? He had proclaimed Christian conservatives were a bunch of bigots and no one would buy that? Now, the best part of this interview comes a little later, 18-minute interview, is when Matt categorizes conservatism as a cult. And he announced, "I thought I could change it, but I was wrong. There is no saving of conservatism. It has to be destroyed." This was the best part because the liberal host here, Brooke Gladstone, actually laughed. Maybe because that echo of Pinky in the Brain had emerged. Then, a few days later, came the NPR show On Point on November 23. That's syndicated to NPR stations across the country out of WBUR in Boston. Well, now Matthew is putting more specifics into his wonderful book story. Although it was still so vague on the particulars, it's sort of hard to pin down which conservative did what. The host, Meghna Chakrabarty, certainly made no attempt to fact-check Sheffield on this. So about 9 minutes in comes this tale.
In 2012, as I had, you know, become sort of wary that conservatives didn't understand politics or didn't understand how many people didn't really believe in slashing the government the way that my colleagues did, I started writing a book, and I had a major publisher. I wrote 80,000 words of it, and I started showing it to some of my clients and coworkers. And one of the points in the book was that, you know, America is becoming the biggest demographic change in this country is the growth of secularization. So people who don't believe in the religion that they were raised in. And that is something that I said that conservatives have to make peace with and to accept secular people in their coalition. And I showed that part of the book to several colleagues who were, you know, more devout traditionalist Christians, and they hated that part. And some of them actually started trying to get me fired from jobs, which is really ironic because, you know, conservatives love to say that liberals have a cancel culture where they don't like, where they try to censor opposing views. But I lived that, but it was conservatives who did it.
The cancel culture. I lived that. This is where we all look at each other and say, what on earth is he talking about? Now, in 2012, Matthew was still working with us at Newsbusters, although he was always boasting of other ventures and grand plans. He had a little firm called Dialogue New Media, so that's where the clients come in. I have no recall whatsoever of him boasting of a contract with a major publisher. And given Matthew's ego, he would have certainly shared this news with us. I find it odd that you'd say you wrote 80,000 words for a major publisher and the book never happened. Did he return the advance? What happened that he didn't finish it? NPR did not ask. I'm especially suspicious of the claim that he showed part of this book with so-called devout traditionalist Christians among his colleagues. We're not all devout Christians here at the MRC, but I'm sure that would be his description of me, church-going Roman Catholic choir guy. I was never shown a passage of the book like this, and I don't know why. I would be hostile to the idea of conservatives accepting secular voters in a conservative coalition. We work with more secular conservatives all the time. It's downright comical that someone at the Media Research Center would be trying to get him fired for making this argument. I never tried to get him fired. Matthew basically walked away in 2014 because he didn't want to work here in the office, and Brent Bozell wanted a full-time executive editor here at HQ. The title was given to me. and Matt just sort of floated away from us. There was no abrupt dismissal, just a sort of a reluctant parting of the ways. In this particular case, I decided I would email WBUR and suggest this whole story seems incredibly fishy to me, that it doesn't match our reality. No one there has yet to reply. But you have to laugh a little to see that WBUR on its website boasts this show under Meghna Chakrabarty is now, quote-unquote, defined by editorial rigor. I don't know what editorial rigor was applied to Matt here. The show is based on, quote, her magnificent mind and her relentless curiosity. Whatever. You know, that was not on display with Matt. She wanted to believe everything that was being said. She surely enjoyed Matt insisting funders of right-wing media need to face negative business consequences for what they do. Matt said, Rupert Murdoch is enabling the growth of a fanatical movement in this country, and funders like Murdoch have to be stopped. Talk about democracy dying in darkness. We recently noted one more podcast on December 4, something called The Long Game on Yahoo with John Ward. The headline was goofy. Quote, he fought liberal bias in media, but then realized he didn't understand journalism. Unquote. For some reason, Matt was surprisingly playing dumb. I didn't understand that journalism is supposed to portray reality, he claimed. I mean, how old are you? What do you think journalism is? What do you think the news is supposed to be? Why do people turn on the news? They're looking to see what happened. Part of the problem with the so-called news now is it doesn't tell you the reality of what happened today. It's constantly trying to dish about what might happen tomorrow. So, you know, speaking of reality, now Matt is telling John Ward about his alleged book publisher and his alleged manuscript. He claimed they thought it was the best conservative book they had seen in decades. Really? I mean, it never saw the light of day. Yeah, this is what it sounds like, a fish story. I had the biggest fish ever. Oh, where is it? I don't know. I lost it. Now Matt tells everybody he's writing a memoir on his terrible upbringing in a Mormon household. You wonder if that, too, will be the best book that never gets published. Ward ended his interview by saying, I hope you write that memoir of yours. I would not bet a nickel on it. Speaking of reality, you might notice on this little tour that Matt often talks of quote-unquote starting Newsbusters without even mentioning us at the MRC. Ward asked him who the co-founder was, and he said his brother Greg. No mention of us. You can go to Matt's LinkedIn page, and there's no whisper there of his time with the MRC. 9 years. He told Ward he still has friendly ties on the right, at least with the websites that have, quote, editorial integrity, unquote. Well, obviously, he's not including us on his list because we don't have friendly ties. So maybe I've spent too much time on this subject, but in the roundabout way that Newsbusters was discussed here, I thought maybe we could push back a little on this narrative that Matt is selling. He worked alongside us for almost 10 years, and he never told us to our face that we didn't know anything about how journalism works. He certainly told us about how knowledgeable he was. That part never changes. Well, as this very depressing year of disease ends, we wish you a much happier 2021. We will be here to chronicle what we all suspect will be a massive change of approach in how the White House is covered. We will bring our decades of experience to the task of analyzing all the pro-Biden media coverage. So come once, come twice, 24 times a day to Newsbusters. And thank you for listening.